Time's wheel runs back or stops. Potter and clay endure. Robert Browning. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you'll enjoy and go back to our backlog of episodes. And if you're a returning listener, thank you guys. As always, I really appreciate your support. Please like, rate 5 stars, download, subscribe, all that kind of good stuff. On whatever platform you're listening to me on to, you know, kind of help support the show and keep it growing. I also want to hear if you guys like the new theme song. I hope you were able to listen to it pretty well last week. It was a little bit louder than the last one was, at least when it's initially uploaded. I did lower it a little bit more, but I also think that was a little bit of a problem for maybe it coming through initially. So hopefully, I'll get that a little bit more fine-tuned this week. But please let me know if you have any feedback on that or anything else. Now this week, the goal is to cover the sites in western/central Anatolia that we didn't talk about when we were kind of in the Mesopotamia, Levant region, as well as mainland Greece between 6 and 4,000 BC, BCE. And we may also get to the islands of the Aegean Sea, though that is probably going to be next week's topic. And we may cut either Greece or Anatolia. I'm still trying to figure out, because there is something I forgot to talk about last week. And that is something that I'm going to cover to start this episode off. And I noticed my mistake last week when I was editing the YouTube episode and putting pictures in. I saw a whole bunch of pictures I had saved for a culture I completely missed that I meant to talk about when we were kind of finishing up. So I'm going to go ahead and start by talking about the Sokuta Bobange Krivadol culture. And this is also, that can also be combined in several different ways. It could be the Bobange Sokuta Krivadol culture or the Krivadol Sokuta Bobange, etc. You can rearrange that however you want. The name given to this culture is one of those instances where, depending on the country you're in, it has a different name. Bobange is the Serbian name, Krivadol is the Bulgarian term, and Sokuta is the Romanian name. Each name comes from the type site found in those countries belonging to said culture. Internationally, the names are combined. I'm just going to be abbreviating it as SBK, when I can, but I'll probably also just refer to it as the Sokuta, because that's the sources I was mostly able to read refer to it as that. But as you can guess from the name, it was located in kind of the border regions in those modern-day countries. I also think they had some sites in what is now northern Macedonia and the north of Greece. And they developed out of some of the East of Vinča culture sites in those countries. Remember, the Vinča culture disappears around 4,500 at most of their locations. And these sites all developed a new local culture. And this culture is firmly within the Chalcolithic or the Neolithic or the Copper Age, whatever you want to call it. And they had strong trade links with the Gulmanida culture, who they were contemporaneous with, and many Gulmanida artifacts, mostly pottery, have been found at their sites, but they still produced their own artifacts. One paper I read specifically mentioned that they created their own types of copper axes that were different than what you'll see the Gulmanida possess. They also had links with the Tisza Bulgar and their successors, the Bodrog Karastor culture. Now, we've not discussed the Bodrog Karastor culture just yet. I think I mentioned them as the successors to the Tisza Bulgar, but they're kind of come along at the very tail end of this season, and most of their artifacts come from next season's time period. So we're not going to talk about them too much. But it does appear that the Bodrog Karazor will replace them in the north of the Salcutta territory. Was this a violent replacement? Possibly. Despite what some say about a peaceful Neolithic or Chalcolithic Europe, most SBK sites were partially or fully fortified with trenches and short sections of walls between said trenches or covering parts of their settlement that were maybe might be easier to sneak up on otherwise. Archaeologists refer to the short section of walls as vallum. So if you see that term, that's what it means. It basically just means a short section of a wall not connected to anything else. Now, another unique set of artifacts created by the SBK are humanoid figures. Now, obviously, those aren't unique in and of themselves, but their designs on them are unique. They were mostly made out of clay, some with bone, and there are some that are male or an indeterminate gender, but most are, you know, identified as female due to the presence of breasts. And these were all intricately incised with patterns, usually lines, though there were dots or kind of like circular markings on them as well. They also would create some animals or animals with humanoid features, but these were almost entirely made out of stone as opposed to bone and clay. Their pottery is very well made, but it does have some more simplistic artistic designs. Mostly it was brown with some inside zigzags or straight lines. Some had no decoration at all. Some were painted. And I also saw references that some were made with a graphite shading. Now, I couldn't find pictures of this graphite shading, but in artistic terms, this doesn't mean that they use graphite in the production of these clay vessels. Instead, that refers to a color range of maybe a light gray to maybe some shades of blue are sometimes considered graphite shaded, even though graphite is obviously not blue at all. They also had a wide variety of shapes and sizes, including some with fluted mouths, and in some cases they were made with lids to cover up the pots. And they also made small ceramic tables that many believe served as some type of altars, where perhaps they would put those figurines that they were creating on them. Now, they buried their dead on their left sides in kneeling positions. Adults were typically buried outside of settlements with some amounts of grave goods, and this includes things like ceramics, tools, ornaments, and in some cases, animal flesh. Now, obviously, the animal flesh has degraded in the ground, but they have found, of course, the bones of the animals, and these aren't like full skeletons. These are maybe like a leg bone or, you know, a rib or a couple of ribs, perhaps, of some animal that would have been cooked, maybe to sustain them in the afterlife once they arrived. And they've also found a small number of cases where they would bury children on the edges of their homes, typically around the side of the walls where the hearth was located. They would kind of be on closer to the outside of the hearth or the outside of the wall. So not necessarily under the house directly, but maybe right under the outer section of wherever the hearths were located. And they typically put the hearths either on one of the corners of the house or on one of the long walls themselves. That's usually where they were located. The children are not given grave goods. Instead, they were buried in large ceramic what may have been initially set up as a large ceramic oven or maybe a large jar. They would place the deceased child in the jar, pack it with earth, and then bury that underneath the area that they chose to deposit the dead. And then they would also kind of ram a rod or something like that into the space to allow kind of like a drain, essentially, for water to filter down to the dead, probably as some type of voting offering, giving the children something to drink in the afterlife as opposed to having meat. At least that's the predominant theory. And this is something I think we've mentioned before. I'm pretty sure I talked about it in some of the sites in the Middle East. And even when we get to recorded history in sites in Mesopotamia, this is a practice that is still done. And not just for children. This is done for all of the dead buried underneath a home. Now, their homes were rectangular with internal partitions, but not full walls. And all of them had small hearths in one of the corners, like I said. And the walls were made of wooden supports, and then they would cover those in wattle and daub to kind of create the exterior and the interior walls of their home. Now, the SBK do not last that long. They last from around 4,500 or 4,400. The date varies a little, until about 4,000 BC. So only around, at most, 500 years. On the short term, about 400 years. So they're roughly contemporaneous with the Gulmanita, who they, again, had very close trade links with. And perhaps once the Gulmanita declined, they declined as well, because, again, we know that they're trade partners, whereas with their neighbors to the north, you know, there's at least the potential that they were less friendly with, if the evidence of some of those cultures moving south into their northern territories is anything to go by. Though, again, those sites could have been declined and replaced peacefully. It's hard to say 100%, but again, the fortified settlements do tend to suggest that they were under some type of external pressure, either from their neighbors or perhaps from people who shared somewhat of a cultural or material identity with them. Now, with the Balkans finally out of the way, minus Greece, of course, we are going to go ahead and move on over to Western Anatolia. Now, we've talked about Eastern Anatolia, a little bit of Central Anatolia. Let's kind of talk about the kind of part we skipped. And the reason I did that is because culturally, they're a little bit of, I wouldn't say a mystery, because obviously we have a lot of their artifacts. We've discovered a number of sites. But Anatolia, when it comes to archaeology in the region, there's not really a term for all these Western Anatolian, Central Anatolian sites that are not, that don't belong to any of the surrounding or neighboring cultures. There's not an umbrella term to describe them, the same way you see in Europe or East Asia or Mesopotamia or the Levant. They're just, each site is referred to individually, so they're all their own entity. And I'm not sure why that is. I'm not sure why archaeologists don't have a larger term to describe this area. We know they had at least some level of contact with each other, or at least one or two sites had contact with one or two other. They may not have all known about each other. They're all making similar pottery and humanoid figures, not to mention that they all have the same economy, agricultural base with a level of herding built in, with specifically the cow being the most important animal that they have access to. The answer seems to be, at least from someone who's not an archaeologist, just a historian, seems to be that each of the larger regional sites, they seem to have enough of a difference from each other to separate them all from each other. And even the smaller villages or, you know, farmsteads between those larger sites don't seem to have enough of a connection with their closest large site or their closest proto-city, if you will. Though, again, we're not talking about cities yet in this region. And there's some level of difference between each of these villages. So there doesn't seem to be enough of a material connection to kind of group them all together. Now, this may be something that archaeologists are debating and have been going in about, but I, or, you know, going back and forth on, but I haven't come across anything that suggests they do. So that's just my guess. So I'm not quite sure why that is. Also, some of the larger sites fall under influence from the neighboring cultures of the Middle East, like the Halaf, who we talked about earlier this season. The sites that I should bring up are known as Bayan Ses Sultan, Khan Hashan, Mersin Yumuktepe, Hasilar, Nursuntepe, and Istanbul Fikirtepe. And that may be a mispronunciation. Apologies if that is the case. And there are a couple of other ones as well, but those are the ones that I've seen mentioned the most. And these, some of these were even Neolithic sites. I believe I've talked about Hasilar last season when talking about Anatolia. I don't think I went into too much detail on it, but it is still thriving during this season. And during this season, all of these sites enter into the Copper Age, and they enter into it anywhere between 1500 to about 900 years before some of the copper producing sites in Europe. Though the level of copper artifacts they use don't really get they don't really get to the level of copper tools until around the same time as some of those sites in Europe. Prior to that, they're mainly making copper beads and jewelry and things like that. So nothing too practical. It's more ornamental or perhaps spiritual. The most important site I'm going to focus on talking about this area is going to be Hasilar. Now, this site, again, I've talked about it before, was first occupied right around 7000 BC. It was probably an offshoot of Çatalhöyük, or at least people living there were descendants of people who had lived at Çatalhöyük. And initially it was a Neolithic site, and it did not have pottery. So it's in that aceramic pottery period in the Middle East, Levant. Then, around the start of this season, they do begin to have pottery show up in their record. And it looks similar in style to a lot of the Halaf pottery. However, it's not quite as well made. It's almost all completely undecorated, but in terms of shape and size, very similar to what you see at Halaf sites and their vessels. So they were probably at least seeing examples of Halaf pottery from people kind of in central Anatolia. And that type of simple pottery is produced from about 6000 to about 5600 BC. Around that time, you see more buildings go up at the site. I think they found 9 underground that were, you know, pretty well preserved. And they're all grouped around a square, kind of like the each house is kind of like on a, like if the square is the center, it's kind of like a little town center area. And it's mostly agriculture, wheat, barley. They had vetch. I think they found some peas and spelt there as well. They were breeding animals. They found, again, cattle, pigs, sheep, goats, dogs. All those were bones have been found at that site. And the pottery is still simple, but it's more well made. They may have been painting it at that point. There is some debate on that. But it's still, you know, not too highly decorated. However, they do begin to find female figures. And they're made of clay, and they're very, very unique, at least when you compare what we saw in Europe. The body is definitely feminine. They have wide hips. It looks like they're designed to either just represent a sitting woman, perhaps kneeling. Her arms are kind of folded over her stomach. And then, of course, you can see her chest. The face is very blank. It's just pointed with two, like, eye holes as well, you'll see. So they have very pointy heads, which we've talked about cranial deformation in some places in the Middle East. So, though I don't think there's any evidence of these sites having cranial deformation of any of its inhabitants. At least I didn't see anything mentioned, but it's certainly possible, I guess, in some cases. The next big change that we find at the site, it comes around, or it's dated to around 5,300. So about 300 years after the last big change, we see that the village is now fortified. It has walls as well as deep ditches. In some cases, they're referred to as trenches. So probably a lot more than what you would need for mere animal control. Though again, this is debated. And also there was a building found dated to that period that it appears to have been some type of area for worship. They have found a large number of the seated woman figures, as well as what appears to be perhaps an altar of stone. And it doesn't look like anyone was living there. It was not a large building. That, again, dates to around 5,300. After that, the next big change comes around 5,000 BC. Now, this is one of the more debated aspects of Hasselar. Now, again, this is about 300 years after the last layer that showed a lot of changes. At this point, there appears to have been fire damage shortly before 5000 BC, destroying a large amount of the older Hasselar settlements. Now, Hasselar had been abandoned before, it had been reoccupied. There is some debate of whether this was an intentional destruction. Maybe the people living in Hasselar abandoned it, intending to return one day, and they destroyed it. We've seen evidence to other places where when people leave a site, they would intentionally pull down the houses, burn them, whatever. But it is odd that this took place, you know, just a couple of hundred years after the site was fortified. When it is reoccupied after 5000 BC, it is much, much, much more heavily fortified. There are bigger, thicker walls. There are deeper ditches. And the pottery is very different as well. This pottery is now much higher quality, a lot of different shapes and sizes, and it is all painted cream as like a background color. And then you'll see different patterns of red swirls, figures, all that kind of stuff. Painted onto it too. There are still female figures. They're, you know, again, broadly the same, at least in terms of what it's depicting, though the designs on these female figures have changed. So it's believed by a lot of people that between 5300 and 5000 BC, the old site was destroyed in some type of attack. Though, again, there are some people who argue, well, there's no evidence of that. It's just fire. It happens. It could have been a natural, it could have been an accident. You know, these houses are all close together. They're made of, you know, they're built on stone foundations, but they're all made of wattle of daub. They're all close by. They all have wooden floors built on top of them. So a fire could have easily spread. And we know the site had been abandoned in the past. Sometimes the environment was not very conducive to agriculture or growing crops, which is certainly a possibility. But again, it's hard to imagine, that the people who, if they had intentionally abandoned Hasselar, it's hard to imagine them going through that big of a cultural change in just 300 years when you compare them to other cultures who had done similar things. Sometimes, you know, sites are abandoned for a couple hundred years, they come back, and they're kind of in line with, you know, with what had been there before. And we've seen that in other places too. We've talked about it when we, you know, talked about sites in Mesopotamia. So I'm of the opinion that yes, it was probably destroyed in some type of attack. And then reoccupied by another people. Now, was it occupied by the people who destroyed it? That's impossible to say. But who knows? So after 5000 BC, the site continues to be occupied till right around 3000 BC. However, I don't believe it ever gets as large as it did at the 5300 period. Or the 5000 period, I guess. And that's probably due to the environment. It's very near a stream. It's called the Erin Stream. And it's between two lakes. There's a salt lake to the north called Birder Lake. And there is a salt lake to the west called Yarasli Lake. And it's about 5 miles from both of those, which is about 8 kilometers, give or take. You know, it could be a little bit shorter than that. But, you know, you had these two salt lakes nearby. There's a stream that probably helped them grow crops a little, but they're probably very reliant on rainfall. And also during that period where it may have initially, you know, it may have seen that layer of destruction around 5000 BC, the environment was not that conducive to having large population centers. So it's possible that the competition for fertile farmland may have led to the site's destruction. Things do improve, I think, around 4,500 in the area. It may have been a little bit later, may have been a little earlier. I can't remember the date, and I did not write it down in my notes, which was dumb of me. But when it's reoccupied, it's occupied pretty much until the site is abandoned around 3000 BC. And when occupants do return to the area, it's much later. And again, it's never the same size. Other sites become larger population centers because they're better positioned. So that, unfortunately, is the end of Hasilar as a kind of an independent entity, at least as far as we can tell. Well, independent's not really the right word. At least a large-scale location. Again, there are other sites that are, you know, that will continue to be occupied. One that's a good example is Beyses Sultan. This is a little bit further to the west of from Hasilar. And it's first occupied right around the time that Hasilar is destroyed around 5000, maybe a little bit before then, and it's occupied clear through to the end of the 4th millennium. In fact, it's occupied even further. There are Bronze Age sites too, though again, it does see periods of abandonment, but Beyses Sultan, like I said, is one of those sites that is more conducive to having larger populations, and it will be the site of, I think, clear until... I think past the Bronze Age. But we'll talk more about them later. They're not very large at this time. They don't have anything that really stands out about them that separates. You know, they're not as advanced as Hasilar is. Their houses are very similarly made. Though they add benches along their walls, which is not something I saw mentioned at Hasilar. But they don't really begin to grow in size until the Bronze Age really kicks off. And they probably benefited a lot from the copper trade. Copper coming from Europe into Asia. Basically, there's such a high demand for copper in Mesopotamia and the Levant and Egypt. They will get it from as far away as possible. Copper's in very high demand, basically going forward. In history until, you know, the advent of iron. And even then, you know, copper still has its uses, but, you know, eventually it will be replaced by the iron manufacturing and forging and all that kind of stuff. But due to the copper trade, a large number of sites in this area will become very rich, and they will be fought over by a number of peoples. So, again, I know there's not a lot to kind of go on when we talk about Anatolia at this time period, but there is stuff happening. It's just, it's not assigned to any one group of people the way you see in, say, East Asia or Mesopotamia. Now, there is one other thing I want to talk about in Anatolia before we move back over to Greece. There's not a lot of sites that have been dated to this period in northern Anatolia. And that's more, again, northwest Anatolia, not so much northeast. We've talked about the Caucasus and their neighboring region. There's plenty of sites there. However, kind of in north central and northwestern Anatolia, there's not a whole lot going on because there is kind of a drought. Remember, irrigation is just kind of being figured out in a couple of places, like large scale that you would need to kind of irrigate large amounts of farmland. But there's not any real rivers flowing down that could support, at least with the technology available, that could support large agricultural settlements. So it's probably filled with some holdout hunter-gatherers, herders, but there's not any large settlements along kind of the northern side of Anatolia at this season, or this point in human history. Now that will change, the drought will lessen, eventually better rains will come in, but that is something that you should keep in mind. It's why we're not talking about that part of Anatolia really much this season. Oh, and I'll point this out, and I'll try to include a picture in the YouTube episode. But Bessesultan is about 50 miles to the northwest of where Hasilar is, which is around 83 kilometers, I think. 83, 82, something like that. Now, that's a straight line. You cannot just march a straight line directly to them. I think even today, the road network makes you, if you were to go around, if you were to leave from Hasilar, you'd have to drive northwest and then take an eastern path. And then you would kind of skirt an outs, like kind of the southern edge of another mountain range. And then you would get to, it's Isikli Golu, which is Isikli Lake or Lake Isikli. And then about, I think about, Bessesultan is about, 7 miles to the west of, that lake, which is around 12 kilometers. So, salt lakes were important, apparently. They were probably, again, producing salt from these lakes to help preserve their food and things like that. Now, back to Greece. So, I've mentioned this site last season when we were talking about Europe. But this site is Sesklo, or Sesklo. I'm not quite sure of the pronunciation. I've heard it different ways depending on the person speaking, but it's S-E-S-K-L-O. And this is found in what is now Thessaly. That's the administrative region. I'm not sure if they have counties or anything like that, but it's Thessaly. And it was first occupied by what appears to be hunter-gatherers, and that happened as early as around 6,800. They were probably starting to live a slightly more Neolithic lifestyle, more sedentary, because of the, you know, the kind of the rough conditions further north. Now, those conditions were softening, but it was still probably hard to get a lot of food if you're hunting and gathering those areas. So they opted to move further south, where it was warmer, sunnier, better protected. There's a lot of, you know, mountains nearby that you could retreat into if you needed, if you were maybe outnumbered. Now, starting around 6,000, 6,300, you begin to see Animal Bones show up at Sesklo and other sites. There's another site nearby called Agrissa, also in Thessaly, where there's a lot more cattle bone. So this tends to indicate that people are bringing in domesticated cattle. So it's here that you see a mix, the first mixing of Eastern hunter-gatherers with these early Anatolian farmers. And we saw this happen in the Balkans in a later period, but it's happening here first at Schlesko. And it's, again, about 300, 400 years before the start of this season. Very quickly, the Neolithic lifestyle takes over at Schlesko and the remaining kind of nearby areas. You see more crops being grown. You see cattle bones show up a lot more, as well as goat and sheep and things like that. Of course, pottery becomes popular in the area. It becomes and it begins to be produced in the area. And most of this is kind of a light brown or a kind of an off-white with kind of darker patterns painted onto it or maybe glazed onto it. And this kind of lifestyle really kind of settles in for the long haul. Schlesko itself will be occupied until about 4,400 BC. But right around 5,000 BC, the site gets to cover an area of about 20 hectares. And this is its largest, the largest it gets. It has about 500 to 800 houses, and people estimate its population could have been as large as 5,000 people. And there are, of course, numerous outlying villages and things like that as well. The homes are very small, too. They're not large. They're typically square with maybe one or two rooms, depending on the size. They're made of wood or mud brick, though they do have adobe walls and kind of covering the walls as well. And they're all built up on stone foundations. Some of these homes may have even had like subterranean rooms dug down. So they would have been two floors, a ground floor and a subterranean floor. This also may have just been like a storage area. It's hard to say. They're also making female figures. They have the similar motif with the woman kind of guarding her stomach in some of them, though there are some where it's just the upper torso where her hands cover her breasts. There's also one from around sometime between 4,800 and 4,500 of a woman holding a child, or at least like a woman's body. The heads have been destroyed or they were never made. It's hard to say, at least from the picture I saw, but it's a woman holding a baby in her arms. And I'll try to include pictures of those as well. But Schlesko stays, again, their high water mark is about 5,000 BC. The site's pretty big. After that, things start to go downhill. And there's a couple of thoughts about this. Before I get to that, though, also the Schlesko people, or at least people related to the first Neolithic farmers at Schlesko, are also the ones who established the Strachevo and the Koros Kris culture. We talked about that migration pattern earlier, but just wanted to remind you guys of that and point that out here and now. Not everyone stayed in what is now Greece. Now, as I was saying, the Schlesko, again, their high water mark's 5,000 BC, and they start to hit a decline. Now, why this is you know, debated, but they disappear around 4,400. Another material culture rises not far from Schlesko. It's at a site known as Domini or Dominion, depending on the rendering in Greek. It's had different spellings at different times. But the Dominion culture was initially thought to have been a new wave of migrants from Anatolia, and it is thought that they destroyed the Schlesko shortly after 5000 BC. However, with new dating and pottery techniques, they've determined that there was about a 400-year period where the Domini and the Schliss Cohens, were, you know, they lived fairly close to each other and were reasonably peaceful neighbors. However, eventually, something caused the Dominion art style to become more popular. Now, is it the decline of Schlesko that was just unnatural? Maybe the settlement was no longer as prosperous. Maybe there was internal turmoil at Schlesko. Maybe the Dominions conquered it, but there's no evidence of that. And again, there's that 400-year period where they're neighbors, and they're, some sites are right beside each other, and they would have overlapped. You know, they would have perfectly lined up with each other. They would have been absolutely neighbors with each other. So we don't really know. However, eventually the Dominion art style does take over. And I'll put a picture in the YouTube episode, but their pottery is a lot more intricate in terms of art style. They are fortifying their settlements with walls, and these are walls surrounding the settlement, connected. In some cases, they're kind of stepped wall fortifications. So why the Domini were able to overcome, or why they lasted longer than the Schlesko, is hard to say, at least from the archaeological evidence. Again, maybe Schlesko had internal problems and the Domini took advantage. Maybe it was just a natural progression of art. Maybe the Domini grew out of Schlesko and they didn't see a difference between them, at least ethnically speaking. And the Domini pottery is very popular. It is spread along some of those trade sites. They found it as far away as Albania. So, don't underestimate how popular and influential art could be at that period. Though again, you know, do they consider themselves the same people? It's hard to say. But I think that will cover it. The Domini houses are very similar. I think they're slightly larger from what I was able to figure out, at least in terms of the size of the houses. I don't think Domini ever got to the same size as Schlesko. Though it's hard to say, because eventually where Domini is would be reoccupied by Mycenaean settlements, so some of their older sites could have kind of been damaged during those periods as well. But I think that will cover where we need to go for this week. And we're already at 42 minutes. Okay, well, almost 43. So that'll go ahead and cover it for this week. Next week, we're going to cover some of the Aegean island cultures, and then we'll move on to other parts of Europe, probably Italy next. But I do want to thank you guys for coming out. I hope you have enjoyed this week's episode. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me via email at war@revpod@gmail.com. You can also contact me via direct message on X/Twitter. Or you can comment on YouTube videos. I do read those as you know they come in. And I also live stream on YouTube and on Twitch during the week and sometimes the weekends. So if you guys see me live, you're welcome to pop in and say hi. I appreciate you all coming out. Hope you've enjoyed. And I hope you all have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you're listening to this. And I will see you all next time. Peace.